Hey, it's Nishant, and welcome to Higher IQ. It is Wednesday, August 5th. I was thinking back to a time a few months ago when I was in Wisconsin, and I got a jury duty summons in the mail. It turns out that I didn't have to go because I don't live there anymore, which was a relief, but it got me thinking about something I've somehow avoided my entire adult life, which is that I've actually never done jury duty. I've always been on the move, and I've never stayed in one city long enough for the system to catch up with me. And I realized that I couldn't really explain how jury duty works, why it exists, or even why the idea of 12 random people deciding someone's fate actually came from. So I looked into it, and the origin story starts in a place that I wasn't expecting. Before juries existed, the way you proved your innocence in most of Europe was actually by holding a piece of red-hot iron or being thrown into a river. If you survived, then God had declared you innocent. If you didn't, well, then you were guilty and also dead. So what did we have before juries? For most of medieval European history, criminal disputes were settled through what was called trial by ordeal, and the logic behind it was that God would intervene on behalf of the innocent. In the ordeal of hot iron, the accused would carry a piece of heated metal for a set distance. Their hand was then bandaged, sealed, and inspected days later. If the wound was healing cleanly, then God had judged them innocent. If it was infected, then they were guilty. In the ordeal of cold water, the accused was bound and lowered into a body of water that had been blessed by a priest. If they sank, the water had accepted them and they were innocent, at which point they'd be pulled out, hopefully in time. If they floated, the water had rejected them and they were guilty. These weren't fringe practices, by the way. They were actually the standard legal procedure across England and continental Europe for centuries, administered by the church and sanctioned by the crown. The outcomes were considered divine judgments, and since God was the one deciding, there was no appeal. The system worked as long as everyone believed God was participating, which most people did. In the year 1215, two things happened that changed the legal system permanently. The Pope banned trial by ordeal at the Fourth Lateran Council, removing the church's involvement and effectively destroying the theological basis for the practice. And also in the same year, a group of English barons forced King John to sign the Magna Carta, which included the line, quote-unquote, "No free man shall be seized or imprisoned except by the lawful judgment of his peers and by the law of land." That sentence is the origin of the jury system as we know it. With the ordeals gone, English courts needed a new way to determine guilt, and trial by a jury of citizens emerged to fill the gap. The system that most Americans treat as an inconvenience replaced a system where your innocence depended on whether or not you could hold a piece of hot metal without getting an infection. The Founding Fathers considered jury trials so fundamental to a free society that they put in two separate amendments to the Constitution. The Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to a jury trial in criminal cases, and the Seventh Amendment, which guarantees it in civil cases. No other right in the Bill of Rights gets mentioned twice. And juries have a power that almost nobody knows about, including most people who serve on them. Jury nullification. Have you heard of this? It's the idea that a jury can vote to acquit a defendant even if the evidence clearly shows that they broke the law and no one can punish them for it. If all 12 jurors decide that the law itself is unjust, or that applying it in this specific case would be wrong, they can simply say, not guilty, and that is the end of it. The judge can't override them. The prosecution can't retry the case. The verdict is just final. The power was actually established in 1670, when a London jury refused to convict two Quakers for illegal preaching, and the judge jailed the jurors for the refusal. A higher court freed the jurors and established the principle that juries cannot be punished for their verdicts. Lawyers are generally not allowed to tell jurors about nullification during a trial, and judges actively discourage it, which means most people who serve on juries never learn that they have this power. Whether that's a feature or a bug depends on how much you trust 12 random people to override the legal system. But the power exists, and it's been used throughout American history, including by northern juries who refused to convict people accused of violating the Fugitive Slave Act. The irony of all of this, with jury duty, is that this right that founders of America considered important enough to protect twice is now something that most Americans actively try to avoid. Only about 2% of federal criminal cases go to trial at all, Nearly 90% end in plea deals, which means a jury never hears them. The system that was supposed to stand in between citizens and government power is, in practice, bypassed in the vast majority of cases. The most practical reason that people avoid jury duty is also the most straightforward. The pay is terrible, and the financial burden falls hardest on the people who can least afford it. Mississippi and New Jersey pay jurors $5 a day. Texas and Missouri pay $6 a day. Illinois and South Carolina pay nothing at all for state court service. The national average sits around $22 a day, and federal courts pay about $50, which is still below the federal minimum wage for an 8-hour day. Most states don't require private employers to pay their workers during jury service, which means that an hourly worker called for a 2-week trial loses 2 weeks of income and receives somewhere between nothing and a few hundred dollars from the court to compensate. Hourly workers can't afford to lose 2 weeks of income for $5 a day, so they claim hardship or they just don't show up. High-income professionals also don't show up, but they get out through scheduling conflicts, employer pressure, or attorneys who know how to navigate the system. So who does show up? Well, it tends to be retirees, government employees whose agencies pay them during service, and people who don't push back. A Cornell Journal of Law and Public Policy analysis found that the jury pool ends up skewing older and less representative of the community it's supposed to reflect, and the enforcement of no-shows is inconsistent enough that many people skip it without consequence. The funding gap is almost comically small relative to the principle at stake, too. Connecticut, which pays jurors $50 a day, one of the highest rates in the country, spent less than $500,000 total on juror compensation in 2017. For a state with a $23 billion annual budget, the cost of fairly compensating the people who make the justice system function is a rounding error, and most states haven't bothered to round up. The right that was important enough to enshrine in two constitutional amendments and that replaced a system where guilt was determined by whether you could survive being thrown into a river pays less than a parking ticket in most jurisdictions. Okay, let's close this one out. Like I said in the beginning, I've never served on a jury, and until this week, I didn't think much about that. Now I'm not sure whether I got lucky by avoiding it, or whether I missed participating in one of the few things the Constitution asks ordinary citizens to do. In my mind, I think that the states and the government should pay people more to show up to jury duty, because it is their right as an American citizen. It's not almost the most convenient thing, but it is a right. Regardless of how you feel about religion, I would much rather have 12 people who I can at least plead my case with decide my fate rather than God, which is what was the case beforehand. Anyway, stay informed, stay curious, and we'll see you tomorrow.